Hey, y'all, I'm Jackie. I'm an alcoholic. I absolutely love this meeting. This is a meeting I've come to since the very beginning when I got sober. And I don't make it quite as much as I used to, but I do love it. And y'all are really special to me. So thanks for letting me be here tonight. But I'm here to introduce a very, very special person in my life. We're in for a real treat tonight to hear Garnet tell her story. I've sponsored Garnet for the last year, and she's an absolute joy in my life, and I've loved seeing her come up in this program, and she's got a willingness and a dedication to this program and to this fellowship, like, it's really unparalleled. And she's not only my sponsee, but she's my friend, and she helps me all the time. She's always willing to help anybody, and she's an awesome person, and I'm very excited to hear her story. I've never heard it before. So, well, I mean, I have, because I listened to her Fifth Step. But with that being said, here's Garnet.
Hey, y'all, my name is Garnet, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Jerry, for asking me to do this. I've known Jerry for a couple years now. I'll start out by saying that I've been around these rooms for a few years, but I have not been sober that entire time. This has been a long and hard road for me, because that's what real alcoholism looks like. For me, the real alcoholic, it only gets worse, and it really takes a beating to come in here and have the willingness to do what it takes to get better. So I went to my first meeting when I was 20 years old, and that was in 2009. And I just picked up a year sober on Sunday. So do the math. It took me a minute. But everything that I've been through and all of my experiences have made me who I am and have made it worth it. And I treasure every day that I have sober now. So I will start at the beginning. I was born on July 2nd, 1988. Born and raised in Atlanta, I grew up in Norcross. My mom and my dad were married at the time when I was born. And my mom is the most driven, amazing woman I've ever met. And I didn't appreciate it until very recently. My dad is a very well-intentioned person, but he is one of us. And to this day, he has no idea. So he was using drugs in our house. He was spending all of our money on drugs so that my mom couldn't buy groceries. And when I was 3 years old and she was my age, she kicked him out. And I think that's the best decision that she ever could have made for us. So she was a single mom for most of my life growing up, and I really treasure that time we had together. She did everything for me. I was her life, and she put me through private school. She was a single mom and put me through private school. That's how amazing this woman is. And, you know, my childhood, despite being raised by a single parent, was pretty normal. I was a very smart child. I always did well in school without really trying, and but I was very quiet. I was very introverted. I remember from a very young age feeling very uncomfortable talking to people. I didn't really know how to act around people. I didn't have any siblings, so I didn't really know how to interact with kids my age. I just knew how to interact with grown-ups because that's who I talked to. So I remember feeling very uncomfortable. I always remember feeling restless. I always had to be doing something. I always had to occupy my time because if I was still, something just didn't feel right. So very normal childhood, went to school, played sports. I had a lot of friends. I actually went to school here. First through eighth grade, and I just realized that standing here. So, but, you know, this is a very small, nurturing environment for kids, and I really blossomed here, and I'm really grateful to my mom for letting me go to school here. But somewhere around the age of 12, I started developing this really horrible authority problem. You couldn't tell me to do anything. If you told me to do something, I would ask you why. Why? And, you know, my mom is tired. You know, her life is me. So she's like, I'm not answering you. I'm not answering questions anymore. Just do it. And I didn't like that. I don't like being told what to do because I think I know everything. So the rebelliousness started. And I thought it was justified because, you know, I'm smart. I'm a straight A student. I'm in all these activities. I'm the perfect child. I never get in trouble. Who are you to tell me anything? And so I graduated from school here. They didn't have a high school at the time, so I went to high school at Marist. And that was the beginning of the end for me. That's when I started to realize that, and this is going to sound ridiculous, it sounds ridiculous to me now, but you know, I grew up in a ranch-style house in Norcross, you know, very modest house. And I started going to school with kids that have more money than God. Like, I'm talking about the kind of money where these kids drove BMWs, they wrecked it over the weekend, and they had a new Mercedes in the lot on Monday morning. Like, that kind of money. And, you know, this is the world I grew up in. This is all I knew, and I felt different. I felt so different, and I felt less than. And I found my new best friend in alcohol. I had a few sips here and there, holidays, Easter, Christmas, I'd have a few sips of wine, and I remember, I wonder what more of that would feel like, because this sip feels really good. I wonder what more would feel like, but I couldn't get it, I couldn't sneak it, I didn't really think that was okay. So I don't remember my first drink, but I remember the first time that I drank like I wanted to. I was with my stepbrother. So my mom had gotten remarried my first year of high school, and we moved in with my stepdad. And my stepbrother is my age. And we were in the basement, and my older stepbrother, who is 10 years older than us, was living in the basement. And he was old enough to drink, so he had a good stockpile down there. And, you know, we did the usual thing that kids in high school do. You take a little bit of everything so that nobody notices that stuff's missing, right? So we're mixing, like, coconut rum and beer and, you know, wine and just stuff that's probably been sitting there forever. And then he said, do you know how to take tequila shots? And I said, no. So he's doing the whole salt on your finger with lime and stuff. I didn't know what I was doing, but I just remember that warm burn going down and that calm in my head that I've been longing for so long, because my head just, you know, sober, it's just crazy. You know, the voices are talking constantly. You know, you're not good enough, something's not right, restless, irritable, discontent, right? So I remember that warm burn and the immediate feeling of calm, and I just wanted more and more and more of it. And I don't know how many drinks I had, but I know that I spent 3 hours throwing up, and my brother had to carry me all the way upstairs and put me in the bed. I woke up the next morning, and I said, I want to do that every day for the rest of my life. Because that's what a real alcoholic looks like. I don't remember consequences. I remember what it feels like to quiet down my brain, which is all I really wanted anyway. So from there started the decline into, I was a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. By day, I was a straight-A student, National Honor Society, track and field star, you name it, I was doing it. You know, we had a dean of discipline at Marist. That's how serious this was. And I got called into his office one day, and he's like, I've never heard of you. You've never been in trouble before. I'm like, I know. I get it. So that was me during the day. By afternoon and night, I was drinking anything I could get my hands on. Started with my parents' liquor cabinet. I was coming home straight after school and drinking whatever I could find and, you know, pouring the water back in the vodka bottle so they wouldn't notice it was missing. You know, that's stuff we all do. And I couldn't get enough of that calm feeling. And I was isolating. I had no friends. Until recently, I had no friends since the age of 15. When I took my first drink, I stopped talking to anybody because nobody could make me feel like alcohol did. I didn't want to be around anybody that would maybe tell me that what I was doing was wrong. And, I was just doing what I was doing and living this double life already in high school. I graduated and I went to Georgia Tech for undergrad. And my college experience was awful. I joined a sorority because I thought it would make my mom happy, because I have a real fear of disappointing people. I think that's my biggest fear in the world is disappointing people. And left to my own devices, I never feel like I'm good enough, ever. I feel like if I'm not perfect, then I'm just crap. You know, it's that extreme. So I joined a sorority because I thought it would make my mom happy. And I continued to do what I do best, and that is drink no matter what and hide it at any cost because I need this to survive at this point. And I started dating a guy when I got to college, and ensued 5 years of just absolute abuse. Abuse sexually, mentally, physically, but I think, I stayed because I wanted that approval. People like me just latch on to somebody and, I need your approval. And that just one moment of approval negates, days and days and days of abuse and just not being treated right. I'm probably talking too fast, aren't I? I really didn't have any friends in college. I was going to class. I was still doing very well. And I graduated from Georgia Tech in 3 years. And I was 20 years old. And I'm not saying any of this so that you guys think I'm like the smartest person alive. I am probably, in my mind, the most dangerous type of alcoholic. I'm a functioning one. So it takes a lot for me to see that I'm messing up. So I graduated from Georgia Tech in 2009. And the summer after I graduated, I was going to start law school at Georgia State that fall. And that summer was just debauchery. I really don't need to explain any of it to you guys. You know what it looks like. It's just bender after bender after bender, because this is what happens when I drink. When I drink, I get that high, that sweet burning feeling as it goes down, and then that just complete calm. And my brain tells me that if I drink more, that feeling is just going to be multiplied and get better and better, and I'm going to feel calmer and calmer. And what happens is I overshoot the mark, and I drink really fast, and by the time I've had 10 drinks, I'm blacked out. That's what our book calls the physical allergy or the phenomenon of craving, and it only exists in the real alcoholic, which is me. When I'm not drinking, I have the obsession of the mind. And that is the most frightening feeling in the world, and I didn't know what it was until I got here. It's that horrible cycle in your brain where you wake up and you've just done something awful. Maybe you went home with someone from the bar, or wrecked your car, or got arrested, whatever. And you wake up in the morning and you say, I'm never going to do that again. I'm sick. I'm ill. I feel remorse. I feel anxiety. I don't really know what I did last night, maybe. So I wake up and I say, I'm never going to do that again, ever. Nothing is worth this. And then by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I've completely forgotten anything that just happened. And I'm already thinking, you know what? I feel really anxious. And it's Tuesday, so I'm going to drink because that's what I do. And that decision that I made in the morning not to drink is completely gone by the afternoon because I have absolutely no defense against taking that first drink. I have absolutely no defense by myself of making a decision not to drink and following through with it. So when I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. And once that thought enters my mind, I'm done. And I drink it, and I'm off to the races, and I can't stop until I'm passed out or blacked out or I run out, and I can't drive anywhere to get it. So I ended up at my first AA meeting at the age of 20. That was in May of 2009. And guys, if you're ending up at an AA meeting before you can legally drink, there might be a problem. But I went to that meeting, and it was a women's meeting. It was Sober Sisters over in Roswell. And there were some kind and welcoming women in that room. And I picked up a white chip that day, and I got a sponsor. And probably the next day, I started drinking again because I thought, you know, I really don't want to spend my 20s in a room with a bunch of old ladies talking about not drinking. You know, I just wasn't interested. That's what I thought AA was. And anybody who is not part of our fellowship and who comes in here for the first time, you know, probably that's what a lot of us thought, that AA is just a bunch of people sitting around in a room and gritting their teeth and talking about not drinking. And I really didn't want any part of that. So I went back out, and I started law school, and I did okay. So up until this point, school was really easy for me. I kind of just breezed right through it. I really didn't have to study, really didn't have to work hard, and I got good grades. Law school is hard, y'all. I was not prepared for that, so I didn't do great. But, you know, I kept convincing myself that, you know what, I've never been arrested. I've never lost a job. I've never really had any real consequences from drinking other than feeling sick, feeling anxious, feeling remorseful. I've got this. You know, I just need to maybe scale it back a little bit. So I tried the things that we probably have all tried. You know, I said liquor's the problem. That's just getting me there way too fast, so I'm going to try beer. Or, you know, I'm just going to buy a certain amount so that, you know, I don't drink too much. Well, all that results in is I buy a small bottle of wine, which to me is 5 drinks. I got in this obsessive counting thing, right? So I would say, okay, 5 is too little, 8 is the sweet spot, 10 is too much. I always got to 10 or 11 or 12, big surprise. So, you know, I tried limiting, you know, buying only a little bit, and then all that ended up in was me having 5 drinks in me and driving to the store to get more. I have driven drunk so many times, y'all, I should have 500,000 DUIs, and I don't, and that has nothing to do with me. That is God watching over me for sure, because I should be in jail or dead right now. But, you know, I tried a lot of things to try and limit my drinking, and it didn't work. Every time I had to go get more, and I always overshot the mark, and I always ended up blacked out. I blacked out every time I drank from the very beginning, every time, without fail. And I'm still dating this abusive guy all this time, and I tell myself that this is why I drink, because the last thing I want to do is admit that it's me. The last thing I want to do is admit that I have a problem, I'm an alcoholic, and I need to stop this. So if I can blame it on somebody else, then it becomes, well, I'm depressed, you know? So I decided I was depressed, and I started seeing a psychiatrist. And I did the thing that I knew best to do, which was lie. This kind of occurred to me the other night. I was leading a book study, and I was like, why do we lie to doctors and psychiatrists? Why do we do that? And it occurred to me that we lie because we're afraid somebody's going to take our solution away. So coming in here is when I realized that alcohol is not my problem. It's not my problem. My problem is that the best way I can visualize it or understand it is that I have this hole inside of me. You'll hear some people call it a spiritual malady. It's like a hole in my soul, right? So I will dump anything in this hole to try and make it better, and nothing fills it up. It's never enough. So alcohol is my solution to that problem, just that empty feeling that I had, and I'm just dumping it in there, and, you know, it may have worked in the beginning, but it stopped working as well over time. So I lied to my psychiatrist. You know, they always ask you, how much do you drink? I have a six-pack every now and then. Yeah, right. I drink one of those big bottles of wine every day, at least. So psychiatrist didn't work. And somewhere around the age of 21, 22, I finally decided that I really wanted to give this AA thing a shot because I felt that kind of despair and depression and loneliness from isolating that I think only alcoholics feel. And I felt like my life was spinning out of control. People didn't trust me. I didn't know what I was doing anymore. And I really wanted to give this thing a shot. And I came off a bender between 2009 and 2010. Between Christmas and New Year's, for 7 days, I have absolutely no idea where I was, who I was with, what I did. I have absolutely no idea. But I came to in my parents' house, and by the grace of God, my uncle is one of us. And at this time, he had been sober for 6 years. And my mom called him and said, please come get her. She's sick. She needs you to come and stay with her. So my uncle runs a halfway house up in Helen, Georgia, and he took me in for about a week before I went back to school, and he took me to an AA meeting, and he gave me his first-year medallion, and he said, take this, and you can give it back to me when you get your own first-year medallion. So I came back to Atlanta, went back to school, and I started really trying to give AA a shot. I really wanted to do this. You know, I'm 21 years old, and I've progressed way beyond any kind of social drinking. Honestly, I was never a social drinker. From the beginning, I was across the line. I drank 2 blackout every time since the age of 15. And 6 years later, I'm done. And I got a sponsor who I think a lot of people in this room know. I won't say her name, but she's an angel on earth. She really is. It makes me emotional just thinking about her. You look in her eyes and you just see the peace of God staring back at you. And, breather. Sorry, guys. Wasn't trying to cry this far in. I haven't talked a lot about what my faith in God looked like up until this point. So I was a pretty smart kid, right? And my extended family is Southern Baptist. And my mom and my stepdad are Catholic. So for those of you who think you got the bad end of the stick being Catholic or being Baptist, I was both. Yeah. So, and that's not a knock on religion. I think religion is great for some people. It wasn't right for me. It's still not. That could change. But it's not my thing for right now. But growing up, I did have religion shoved down my throat. I went to Christian school. I went to Catholic school. My family is very religious, so I very much felt like it was shoved down my throat. And somewhere around the time I started drinking, big surprise, I decided that I was an atheist, And I read all kinds of books about atheism and how God isn't real. I learned all the arguments for why God isn't real. And I would tell anyone who would listen, like, you say the word God, I will start explaining to you why God isn't real. I will. You know, people twice my age, I'm like, oh, you're talking about God? Let me just tell you how delusional and brainwashed you are, because I'm 18 and I know everything. I was an atheist when I really decided to give this a shot. And I saw God in my sponsor's eyes. And I think for a lot of us who come in here as agnostic or atheist, the first time we see God is in other people. Maybe we don't have that personal relationship with him yet, or it, whatever you want to call it. I say God because it's easy. That personal relationship takes a lot of work and a lot of time, but I saw God working in the people in this fellowship. And that was my first start. And I saw how peaceful my sponsor was all the time, no matter what she went through. And I felt peace around being around her. And I just slowly started to open that door a little bit, just a little bit. So during this time, I can't put together more than, 30 days here, 60 days there, 90 days here. But in that time, I opened the door to a relationship with God, and, that was the start of my journey. So I wasn't ready to be sober yet, but at least I was starting to open up to having a spiritual experience of some kind. Also around this time, I met my husband in these rooms, and I was that person who liked to drink and go to meetings. On Halloween of 2010, if you were at the 8111 clubhouse at the 10 o'clock candlelight meeting, you would have found me passed out against the wall in the front row. So if you were there, I'm sorry you had to see that. But shortly thereafter, I met my husband, and we started dating very quickly. Sometimes I guess you just know. But he's one of us too, and we've had a very interesting journey together. We've had time on and time off of being sober, but the last two real attempts I made before this time, he and I were very codependent drinkers. So we came in together, we went out together every single time. And one of us would say, oh, I don't feel like doing this AA thing anymore, I want to drink, and the other one would follow. And then one of us would say, oh, I want to go back to meetings again, and the other one would follow. And it became this very codependent, scary relationship. So not only am I obsessed with alcohol, I'm also obsessed with this person who's drinking with me. We got engaged, we got married, all of that. I was not sober at my wedding, wish I was, but that wasn't in the cards for me. So our drinking relationship together was very ugly. When you put two active alcoholics in a house together who are married, it's really not pretty. Marriage is hard enough, just for normal people, I assume, but for two active alcoholics, it is ugly. And it became a game of who's the better drunk for years. And of course I thought I was, because I am a very high functioning alcoholic. I don't get caught. I don't have consequences, really. My consequences are very emotional. So his consequences looked a lot worse than mine, and it just fed my ego. It fed my ego, and I said, why can't you drink like me? I can drink and get up and go to work in the morning. What's wrong with you? Of course I'm drinking at work. Of course I'm drinking the minute I get home from work, but I can still make it, so I don't know what his problem was. So, I just had this high horse mentality of, being the better drunk, which was just completely delusional, of course. But, you know, that's the kind of person that I am. When I'm in active alcoholism, I live in lies. I can't see the truth. All I can see is my very skewed perception, and I think I know everything. And it's a very scary place for me to be. So this time, I woke up on March 6th of last year, and God opened the most amazing window of grace for me. March 6th was a Friday, and it didn't look any different than any other day. I didn't drink any kind of crazy amount. I didn't get a DUI. I didn't get fired from my job. Nothing happened on this day except that God put the thought in my head that said, if you keep doing this, you are going to die. You are so sick, and you are going to lose everything you have. And you might die slowly, but you're going to die from this if you don't put this down right now. And I did. And I told my husband, tomorrow I'm going to a meeting. And I went to the 8 o'clock meeting over at 8111. And I walked into the room with my friend Lisa, who's here. And she's been such a special part of my journey. We lived together for a short time. I forgot about this. So you think two active alcoholics who are married living together in a house looks bad? Lisa lived with us too. So we had three of us in the house at one time for a short period, and that was fun. You know, one of the gifts of this program is finding friends who are there for you no matter what, and who would do anything for you. And Lisa is one of those people, and I asked her to go to this meeting with me, and she did. She sat next to me and watched me pick up a white chip, and it was my last one. And y'all, I have probably over 50 white chips, but I can tell you that that was my last one. I'm sure of it. And I looked across the room, and I saw Jackie, who I had known before from my time being around the rooms. And she never goes to this meeting, ever. And she just happened to be there. And she gave me her number and said, call me. And I did. And she asked me if I wanted her to be my sponsor because I am so terrified to ask for help. I can't even do it. You know, my ego is so big that I can't even ask for help. So she had to ask me. And I have called her every day for the last year, pretty much without fail. And when I got here this last time, I was hopeless. You know, I had come in desperate many, many times, and I was just tired of being sick. I was tired of playing that endless game of, I'm not going to drink today in the morning, and then by 3 o'clock in the afternoon I'd be drunk, and I'd be kicking myself, you know, why can't I just make a decision and stick to it? That I had come in many times after going through that horrible cycle. But this time, I knew I was going to die. And I was sick and bloated and, you know, just pale and hated myself. And I had no friends. And I don't even know how I had a job anymore. Still that high-functioning thing, I guess. God's consequences for me when I drink don't have anything to do with outside consequences yet. They could. That's a yet for me if I choose to pick up at this point. But for me, my consequences are just completely being devoid of any feeling. If I feel anything, it's pain and it's remorse and it's loneliness like only alcoholics know. And my consequences this time were enough to bring me back in and to realize I was going to die if I didn't put this down. So Jackie and I worked through the steps very quickly. My first step is what I just described, that I had to admit that I was defeated, that alcohol was absolutely my master. If I'm in active alcoholism, I can't stop. I can't stop, and I will pick it up every single time. Every single time. And once I start, I can't stop. And when I'm drinking, I don't care about you. I don't care about my family. All I really care about is getting up out of bed and going to work, but only so that I can make enough money to buy more alcohol and to say that I've never lost anything. That's all I'm capable of doing when I'm drinking, is going to work and coming home and disappearing and isolating. And I had to admit that to myself, that I was defeated, which I don't like to do, because I can do anything that I set my mind to. Anything. I've done it. But I couldn't do this. I could not do this. So that was my step one. My second step was easy for me this time, because at this point I've realized that there's a God working in my life. It's just that when I drink, I shut him out. Because when I drink, that becomes my God. And I don't need a higher power working in my life if I've got my liquid solution, even if it doesn't work anymore. So I looked at the insanity of my life, and I came to believe that God could take that away from me. And I think that the sanity it talks about in step two, you know, that God could restore me to sanity. I don't know about restoring me to sanity, because I was never sane. But I think the sanity it talks about is really restoring me to the ability to think logically about whether I'm going to drink or not. And I have that ability today. I can look at it and say that is a bad idea for me, because I'm safe and protected. My third step is so hard for me, y'all, because I get in this delusional place where I think I've got this. I start getting things back. I start feeling better. Things start going well. My friendships are going well. I have people in my life. My job is going well. My marriage is going well. And I start to think I've got this. And I forget that the only things that I have are things that God has given to me. And the best things that I have are when I put God in the driver's seat. When I take it back, it doesn't go well. My fourth step this time was interesting, because in the past, I didn't think I was a resentful person at all. You know, I don't have an anger problem. I have a fear problem. This time I realized, no, I have a lot of resentments. I hate everybody, but most of all, I hate myself. And we went through all of those resentments, all of those fears, and all of those other harms. And I wrote them all down, just like it outlines in the big book. And I went through them with Jackie, and we went through everything. And I think it took about 5 hours. But I got all of those things off my chest. And just the relief that I felt that I could tell somebody these things, and she looked back at me and said, I've done those things too. And I start getting rid of these things that are blocking me. They're blocking me from God, and they're blocking me from you guys. And I can't function when I've got all these things just sitting in my soul. You know, 6 and 7, I never knew before this time around what 6 and 7 were. I had absolutely no idea, and I have such a big ego, and I think I'm so smart that I was afraid to ask anybody what steps 6 and 7 meant, and I had no idea. And this time it was explained to me that, you know, I have these defects of character, and Jackie made me write them all down on a card that I have to carry around with me so I never forget. There are these things that, you know, I have God-given instincts that I'm supposed to have and I'm supposed to act on. But being the alcoholic that I am, I take everything to the extreme. So I take something that's God-given and good, and I make it something awful. And I'm judgmental, and I'm fearful, and I'm selfish, and I have a big ego, and I'm controlling, and all these things. And I have to ask God to remove these things. And my sponsor told me, you have to act as if you don't have these things. And if you act as if you don't have these defects, eventually they'll start to diminish. Because when I'm acting in all these defects of character, I'm not helpful. All I can do is look at me and think about what I want and what I need and what can I get from you. And if these defects start to diminish, then I can do what I'm really supposed to do, which is give of myself to other people, which I've never done before. I don't care about y'all. I mean, come on. I care about me and getting my drink on and, you know, what is the minimum that I have to do to get whatever it is that I want or what I think I want. And, you know, my job is to give of myself to other people because that's what a fulfilling life looks like to me, and that's how I grow closer to my God. We made my list of amends, and I'm not going to cry. I'll tell you all about one. I had to make amends to my biological father. My dad, I know that he loves me, but he's one of us, and he's probably going to live in active addiction for the rest of his life, and he has never really been there for me the way I needed him to be, and I use that as an excuse to completely shut him out of my life. He got remarried and had two kids, and he has two girls. They are 14 and 12, and they live up in Blue Ridge. And I wrote him a letter, and I drove 2 hours or 1 hour, however far it is, up to Blue Ridge. And I get there, and my stepmom makes amends to me as soon as I walk in the door, and she says, if there's anything that we've ever done to make you not want to be around us, please let me know, and I'll try to make it right. And I said, it's not you, it's me. Because I am so selfish. If you're not giving me what I think you should be giving me, I'm going to cut you out of my life. And I ended up reading the letter that I had written to my dad to both of them. And my dad is never going to be perfect. He's never going to admit to me the things that he's done wrong, probably. But that's not what making amends is about. The book tells us we don't discuss the other person's fault. We discuss our own. And I told him, I'm sorry that I missed holidays and birthdays. I'm sorry that I haven't been there and shared my life with you. I'm sorry that I've cut you out of my life, and I'm not going to do that anymore. And that was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. But the reward of driving up there and reading that letter to them, it was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life. And now we talk every week, and I see them as often as I can. And, you know, that was my first glimpse into family is family, and they're not going to be perfect, and I'm not perfect, but I love them the best way that I know how, and they love me the best way that they know how. And I guess I want to get the point across that making amends is not about saying I'm sorry, even though I am, that making amends was about changing the relationship for the better. 10, 11, and 12 are the most important steps in my life, I think. You know, doing that daily inventory and making sure that things aren't starting to crop up in my life. If they do, then I know what to do. I talk to someone else about them. I make amends if I need to. I pray about it, and I help someone else. And the gifts I get from that are in the 10-step promises. I talked about earlier that sanity has returned, where that mental obsession does not plague me anymore. And the 10-step promises talk about I'm put in a place of neutrality. I'm safe and protected. I can walk down the beer aisle at Publix, and it means nothing to me. And I'll be honest with you guys, that doesn't mean that I haven't had drinking thoughts come in. You know, of course I have, because I'm an alcoholic, and if I didn't think about drinking, I mean, hello, that's what I do. But now that thought comes in, and then it leaves. And I never thought that would happen, because I'm the type of alcoholic that it's so sneaky. That thought that just comes in, and it's out of nowhere. I've got a drink in my hand, and I don't even know how it happened. And for that to be removed from me and not have to take that drink anymore, it's just an absolute miracle. And in 11, I get to talk to God every day, and you know, He talks back to me. Sometimes He talks through you guys to me, and sometimes it'll just be a peace in my heart that I feel, and I know something's the right decision. But I try to grow that relationship the best way I know how every day. And I go out in the morning and sit on my porch and maybe light a cigarette, maybe. And you know, I just sit there as the sun is coming up, and I just think I'm so grateful that I don't have to wake up and take a drink today. And, oh, step 12, my favorite. I love sponsoring other women. To see the despair and hopelessness in another woman's eyes, and she feels like she's dying, and to be able to work with her and see that light come on, and just see that she wants to get better, and she wants to work for this, and that willingness, it's just a beautiful thing. And you know, you really don't know what it means when people say sponsoring other people helps you more than it helps the person. It really does. It's not always convenient. It's not always fun. Sometimes sponsees can be really annoying, but I mean, I wouldn't be honest if I didn't say that, you know, because people don't act right, you know, people don't act like they're supposed to, but the joys that I get from working with other women, I mean, you can't put a price on that. So my life now, I wouldn't trade my life today for anything. And over the last year, I've gone through some really difficult things. The two things that I've struggled most with are financial insecurity. I have this overwhelming fear that I'm going to run out of money, I'm not going to have enough money to pay my bills, I'm going to be out on the street, and that means I'm a failure. And ultimately, that's just a fear of what other people think of me. Really, I don't want to be seen as a failure. I want to be seen like I've got this. So over the last year, I've had just this overwhelming sense of financial insecurity. And my husband has suffered a few job losses over the last few years, and it's been hard for us to get through that. And he got a job offer today. Sorry, y'all, I did not mean to stand up here and cry this much, but that's the gifts of this program. You know, the things that we're so terrified of, it's a waste of time, because God works them out. He always does. I can look back at my life and see where God has shown up, and I didn't deserve it. I never deserved it. I shouldn't be standing up here, but God has a purpose for me, and I always have what I need. So I can either spend my time worrying, or I can spend my time giving of myself to other people and letting God work out the details in the background. I don't know how I want to end this other than to say that the last year has been the most spiritual growth that I've ever experienced. This program works, if you think this program won't work for you, I'm sorry, but, you know, it's worth a try, because if you're like me, you've tried just about everything else. I've tried doctors, I've tried trying to control it myself. None of those things work if you're the real deal, like I am. And it takes what it takes to get to a place where you're willing to give this a shot. And I hope everyone in here gets to that place, because this really does work. And I'm not alone anymore. I think that's one of the best things. Literally, y'all, I had no friends from the age of 15. I was an isolation drinker. I didn't want to have anything to do with anybody. And I have a phone book full of people that I can call if I need something. And I hope that they know they can call me. And I'm so grateful to be here. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to sponsor other women. I'm so grateful for my home group. My home group, I didn't say before, is We Are Not a Glum Lot. We're a big book study, and we meet on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock. And it's just a wonderful fellowship of people who I love so dearly. And when you've been to the absolute pits of hell of loneliness and isolation and despair and just not knowing what to do, having a fellowship of people like that and having a God work in my life is just, it's awesome. It really is. And that doesn't mean that I don't have bad days, because I do. I've gotten lifed on. I broke my nose in a horseback riding accident in November. I got in a car accident a few weeks ago. Life still happens, but I don't have to drink over it. And if y'all think this is corny, I'm sorry, but I just want to read something from the book. It's from A Vision for You. I know you guys have all heard this, but I think this is the best summary of what this program looks like. It says, "Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then." Thank you guys for letting me speak. It's been a pleasure. I hope you got something out of it.